Chapter 10. Log entry, Sol 90. 7 days since Pathfinder, and 7 days closer to home. As I'd hoped, my inbound tracks gave me a path back to Lewis Valley. Then it was 4 sols of easy driving. The hills to my left made it impossible to get lost, and the terrain was smooth. But all good things come to an end. I'm back in Acidalia Planitia now. My outgoing tracks are long gone. It's been 16 days since I was last here. Even timid weather would clear them out in that time. On my way out, I should have made a pile of rocks every time I camped. The land is so flat they'd be visible for kilometers. On second thought, thinking back to making that damn ramp, ugh. So once again, I am the desert wanderer, using Phobos to navigate and hoping I don't stray too far. All I need to do is get within 40 kilometers of the Hab and I'll pick up the beacon. I'm feeling optimistic. For the first time, I think I might get off this planet alive. With that in mind, I'm taking soil and rock samples every time I do an EVA. At first, I figured it was my duty. If I survive, geologists will love me for it. But then it started to get fun. Now, as I drive, I look forward to that simple act of bagging rocks. It just feels nice to be an astronaut again. That's all it is. Not a reluctant farmer, not an electrical engineer, not a long-haul trucker. An astronaut. I'm doing what astronauts do. I missed it. Log entry. Sol 92. I got 2 seconds of signal from the Hab beacon today, then lost it. But it's a good sign. I've been traveling vaguely north-northwest for 2 days. I must be a good 100 kilometers from the Hab. It's a miracle I got any signal at all. Must have been a moment of perfect weather conditions. During the boring-ass days, I'm working my way through the $6 million man from Commander Lewis's inexhaustible collection of 70s tripe. I just watched an episode where Steve Austin fights a Russian Venus probe that landed on Earth by mistake. As an expert in interplanetary travel, I can tell you there are no scientific inaccuracies in the story. It's quite common for probes to land on the wrong planet. Also, the probe's large, flat panel hull is ideal for the high-pressure Venusian atmosphere. And, as we all know, probes often refuse to obey directives, choosing instead to attack humans on sight. So far, Pathfinder hasn't tried to kill me, but I'm keeping an eye on it. Log entry, Sol 93. I found the Hab signal today. I have a solid bearing and direction to go. No more chance to get lost. According to the computer, I'm 24,718 meters away. I'll be home tomorrow. Even if the rover has a catastrophic failure, I'll be fine. I can walk to the Hab from here. I don't know if I've mentioned this before, but I am really fucking sick of being in this rover. I've spent so much time seated or laying down, my back is all screwed up. Of all my crewmates, the one I miss most right now is Beck. He'd fix my aching back, though he'd probably give me a bunch of shit about it.
Why didn't you do stretching exercises? Your body is important. Eat more fiber, or whatever.
At this point, I'd welcome a health lecture. During training, we had to practice the dreaded missed orbit scenario. In the event of a second stage failure during MAV ascent, we'd be in orbit, but too low to reach Hermes. We'd be skimming the upper atmosphere, so our orbit would rapidly decay. NASA would remotely operate Hermes and bring it in for rendezvous. Then we'd get the hell out of there before Hermes caught too much drag. To drill this, they made us stay in the MAV simulator for 3 miserable days. 6 people in an ascent vehicle originally designed for a 23-minute flight. It got a little cramped, and by a little cramped, I mean we wanted to kill each other. Once we got out, Commander Lewis declared, "What happened in missed orbit stays in missed orbit." It may seem trite, but it worked. We put it behind us and got back to normal. I'd give anything for just 5 minutes of missed orbit training. I'm really feeling alone lately. Up till this road trip, I've been too busy to mope, but the long, dull days with nothing to do really drives it home. I'm further away from other humans than anyone has ever been. Man, I hope I get Pathfinder working again. Log entry, Sol 94. Home sweet home. Today I write from my gigantic cavernous hab. The first thing I did when I got in was wave my arms wildly while running in circles. Felt great. I was in that damn rover for 22 sols and couldn't even walk without suiting up. I'll need to endure twice that to get to Ares 4, but that's a problem for later. After a few celebratory laps around the hab, it was time to get to work. First, I fired up the oxygenator and atmospheric regulator. Checking the air levels, everything looked good. There was still CO2, so the plants hadn't suffocated without me exhaling for them. Naturally, I did an exhaustive check on my crops, and they're all healthy. I added my bags of shit to the manure pile. Lovely smell, I can tell you. But once I mixed some soil in, it died down to tolerable levels. I dumped my box of pee into the water reclaimer. I'd been gone over 3 weeks and had left the hab very humid for the sake of the crops. That much water in the air can cause any amount of electrical problems, so I spent the next few hours doing full systems checks on everything. Then I kind of lounged around for a while. I wanted to spend the rest of the day relaxing, but I had more to do. Suiting up, I went out to the rover and dragged the solar cells off the roof. Over the next few hours, I put them back where they belonged, wiring them into the hab's power grid. Getting the lander off the roof was a hell of a lot easier than getting it up there. I detached a strut from the MAV platform and dragged it over to the rover. Leaning it against the hull and digging the other end into the ground for stability, I had a ramp. I should have brought that strut with me to the Pathfinder site. Live and learn. There's no way to get the lander in the airlock. It's just too big. I could probably dismantle it and bring it in a piece at a time, but there's a pretty compelling reason not to. With no magnetic field, Mars has no defense against harsh solar radiation. If I were exposed to it, I'd get so much cancer the cancer would have cancer. So the hab canvas shields from electromagnetic waves. This means the hab itself would block any transmissions if the lander were inside. Speaking of cancer, it was time to get rid of the RTG. It pained me to climb back into the rover, but it had to be done. If the RTG ever broke open, it would kill me to death. NASA decided 4 kilometers was the safe distance, and I wasn't about to second-guess them. Driving back to where Commander Lewis had originally dumped it, I ditched it in the same hole and drove back to the hab. I'll start work on the lander tomorrow. Now, to enjoy a good, long sleep in an actual cot, with the comforting knowledge that when I wake, my morning piss will go into a toilet. Log entry, Sol 95. Today was all about repairs. The Pathfinder mission ended because the lander had an unknown critical failure. Once they lost contact with the lander, they had no idea what became of Sojourner. It might be in better shape. Maybe it just needs power. Power it couldn't get with the solar panels hopelessly caked with dust. Setting it on my workbench, I pried open a panel to peek inside. The battery was a lithium thionyl chloride non-rechargeable. I figured that out from some subtle clues. The shape of the connection points, the thickness of the insulation, and the fact that it had LISOC 12 non-recharge written on it. I cleaned the solar panels thoroughly, then aimed a small flexible lamp directly at them. The battery's long dead, but the panels might be okay, and Sojourner can operate directly off them. We'll see if anything happens. Then it was time to take a look at Sojourner's daddy. I suited up and headed out. On most landers, the weak point is the battery. It's the most delicate component, and when it dies, there's no way to recover. Landers can't just shut down and wait when they have low batteries. Their electronics won't work unless they're at a minimum temperature. So they have heaters to keep the electronics warm. It's a problem that rarely comes up on Earth, but hey, Mars. Over time, the solar panels get covered with dust. Then, winter brings colder temperatures and less daylight. This all combines into a big fuck you from Mars to your lander. Eventually, it's using more power to keep warm than it's getting from the meager daylight that makes it through the dust. Once the battery runs down, the electronics get too cold to operate, and the whole system dies. The solar panels will recharge the battery somewhat, but there's nothing to tell the system to reboot. Anything that could make that decision would be electronics, which would not be working. Eventually, the now unused battery will lose its ability to retain charge. That's the usual cause of death, and I sure hope it's what killed Pathfinder. I piled some leftover parts of the MDV into a makeshift table and ramp. Then I dragged the lander up to my new outdoor workbench. Working in an EVA suit is annoying enough. Bending over the whole time would have been torture. I got my toolkit and started poking around. Opening the outer panel wasn't too hard, and I identified the battery easily enough. JPL labels everything. It's a 40-amp-hour AG-ZR battery with an optimal voltage of 1.5 volts. Wow, they really made these things run on nothing back then. I detached the battery and headed back inside. I checked it with my electronics kit, and sure enough, it's dead. 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 I could shuffle across a carpet and hold more charge. So I knew what it needed. 1.5 volts. Compared to the makeshift crap I've been gluing together since Sol 6, this was a breeze. I have voltage controllers in my kit. It only took me 15 minutes to put a controller on a reserve power line, then another hour to go outside and run the line to where the battery used to be. Then there's the issue of heat. It's a good idea to keep electronics above negative 40 Celsius. The temperature today is a brisk negative 63 Celsius. The battery was big and easy to identify, but I had no clue where the heaters were. Even if I knew, it'd be too risky to hook them directly to power. I could easily fry the whole system. So instead, I went to good old spare parts Rover 1 and stole its environment heater. I've gutted that poor Rover so much it looks like I parked it in a bad part of town. Bringing the heater to my workbench, I hooked it up to hab power. Then I rested it in the lander where the battery used to be. Now I wait and hope. Log entry. Sol 96. I was really hoping I'd wake up to a functional lander, but no such luck. Its high-gain antenna is right where I last saw it. Why does that matter? Well, I'll tell you. If the lander comes back to life, and that's a big if, it'll try to establish contact with Earth. Problem is, nobody's listening. It's not like the Pathfinder team is hanging around JPL just in case their long-dead probe is repaired by a wayward astronaut. The Deep Space Network and SETI are my best bets for picking up the signal. If either of them caught a blip from Pathfinder, they'd tell JPL. JPL would quickly figure out what was going on, especially when they triangulated the signal to my landing site. They'd tell the lander where Earth is, and it would angle the high-gain antenna appropriately. That there, the angling of the antenna, is how I'll know if it linked up. So far, no action. There's still hope. Any number of reasons could be delaying things. The rover heater is designed to heat air at one atmosphere. The thin Martian air severely hampers its ability to work, so the electronics might need more time to warm up. Also, Earth is only visible during the day. I, hopefully, fixed the lander yesterday evening. It's morning now, so most of the intervening time has been night. No Earth. Sojourner's also showing no signs of life. It's been in the nice, warm environment of the hab all night, with plenty of light on its sparkling clean solar cells. Maybe it's running an extended self-check or staying still until it hears from the lander or something. I'll just have to put it out of my mind for now. Pathfinder log. Sol 0. Boot sequence initiated. Time. 0 hours, 0 minutes, 0 seconds. Loss of power detected. Time, date, unreliable. Loading OS. VXWare Operating System, copyright Wind River Systems, performing hardware check. Interior temperature, negative 34 Celsius. Exterior temperature, non-functional. Battery, full. High gain, okay. Low gain, okay. Wind sensor, non-functional. Meteorology, non-functional. ASI, non-functional. Imager, okay. Rover ramp, non-functional. Solar A, non-functional. Solar B, non-functional. Solar C, non-functional. Hardware check complete. Broadcasting status. Listening for telemetry signal. Listening for telemetry signal. listening for telemetry signal. Signal acquired. Chapter 11.
Something's coming in.
Yes.
Yes, it's Pathfinder.
The room burst into applause and cheers. Venkat slapped an unknown technician heartily on the back while Bruce pumped his fist in the air. The ad hoc control center was an accomplishment in itself. JPL had just 20 days to piece together antiquated computers, repair broken components, network everything, and install hastily made software to interact with the modern deep space network. A team of engineers had worked around the clock, finishing only 2 days earlier. The room itself was formerly a conference room. JPL had no space ready for the sudden need. Crammed with computers and equipment, little space was left over for the many spectators squeezing in. One Associated Press camera team was permitted. The rest of the media would have to satisfy themselves with the live AP feed and await a press conference. Venkat turned to Bruce.
God damn, Bruce. You really pulled a rabbit out of your hat this time. Good work.
I'm just the director, Bruce said modestly. Thank the guys who got all this shit working.
Oh, I will, Venkat beamed. But first I have to talk to my new best friend.
Turning to the headseted man of the communication console, Venkat asked,
What's your name, new best friend?
Tim, he said, not taking his eyes off the screen.
What now? Venkat asked.
We sent the return telemetry automatically. It'll get there in just over 11 minutes. Once it does, Pathfinder will start high-gain transmissions, so it'll be 22 minutes till we hear from it again.
Venkat's got a doctorate in physics, Tim, Bruce said. You don't need to explain transmission time to him.
Tim shrugged.
You can never tell with managers.
What was in the transmission we got? Venkat asked.
Just the bare bones, a hardware self-check. It's got a lot of non-functional systems, because they were on the panels Watney removed.
What about the camera?
It says the imager's working. We'll have it take a panorama as soon as we can.
Log entry, Sol 97.
It worked.
Holy fucking shit, it worked!
I just checked the lander. The high gain antenna is angled directly at Earth. Pathfinder has no way of knowing where it is, so it has no way of knowing where Earth is. The only way for it to find out is getting a signal. They know I'm alive!
Happy dance, I'm doing a happy dance.
All right, enough happy dance. Time to make with the communicating.
We received the high gain response just over half an hour ago, Venkat said to the assembled press. We immediately directed Pathfinder to take a panoramic image. Hopefully Watney has some kind of message for us. Questions?
The sea of reporters raised their hands.
Kathy, let's start with you, Venkat said, pointing her out.
Thanks, she said. Have you had any contact with the Sojourner rover?
Unfortunately, no, he replied. The lander hasn't been able to connect to Sojourner, and we have no way to contact it directly.
What might be wrong with Sojourner?
I can't even speculate, Venkat said. After spending that long on Mars, anything could be wrong with it.
Best guess?
Our best guess is he took it into the HAB. The lander's signal wouldn't be able to reach Sojourner through HAB canvas.
Pointing to another reporter, he said,
You there.
Marty West, NBC News, Marty said. How will you communicate with Watney once everything's up and running?
That'll be up to Watney, said Venkat. All we have to work with is the camera. He can write notes and hold them up, but how we talk back is trickier.
How so? Marty asked.
Because all we have is the camera platform. That's the only moving part. There are plenty of ways to get information across with just the platform's rotation, but no way to tell Watney about them. He'll have to come up with something and tell us. We'll follow his lead.
Pointing to the next reporter, he said,
Go ahead.
Jill Holbrook, BBC. With a 32-minute round trip and nothing but a single rotating platform to talk with, it'll be a dreadfully slow conversation, won't it?
Yes, it will, Venkat confirmed. It's early morning in Acedalia Planitia right now, and just past 3 a.m. here in Pasadena. We'll be here all night, and that's just for a start. No more questions for now. The panorama is due back in a few minutes. We'll keep you posted.
Quickly leaving the press room, Venkat hurried down the hall to the makeshift Pathfinder control center. He pressed through the throng to the communication console.
"Anything, Tim?"
"Totally," he replied. "But we're staring at this black screen because it's way more interesting than pictures from Mars."
"You're a smartass, Tim," Venkat said.
"Noted." Bruce pushed his way forward.
"Still another few seconds on the clock," he said.
The time passed in silence.
"Getting something," Tim said.
"Yep, it's the panoramic." A general loosening of tension coruscated through the room as the image slowly came through, one vertical stripe at a time.
"Martian surface," Venkat said as the lines displayed. "More surface." "Edge of the hab," Bruce said, pointing to the screen.
"Hab," Venkat smiled.
"More hab now?" "More hab.
Is that a message?"
"That's a message." The vertical stripes revealed a handwritten note suspended at the camera's height by a thin metal rod.
"We got a note from Mark,"
Venkat announced to the room. Applause filled the room, then quickly died down.
"What's it say?"
someone asked. Venkat leaned closer to the screen.
"It says, I'll write questions here. Are you receiving?"
"Okay," said Bruce.
"That's what it says," Venkat shrugged.
"Another note," said Tim, pointing to the screen as the slow march of data revealed itself. Venkat leaned in again.
"This one says, point here for yes."
"All right, I see what he's going for," said Bruce.
"There's the third note," said Tim.
"Point here for no," Venkat read. "We'll check often for answer."
Venkat folded his arms.
"All right, we have communication with Mark. Tim, point the camera at yes, then start taking pictures at 10-minute intervals until he puts another question up."
Log entry. Sol 97. 2.
"Yes! They said yes! I haven't been this excited about a yes since prom night. Okay, calm down. I have limited paper to work with. These cards were intended to label batches of samples. I have about 50 cards. I can use both sides, and if it comes down to it, I can reuse them by scratching out the old question. The Sharpie I'm using will last much longer than the cards, so ink isn't a problem. But I have to do all my writing in the hab. I don't know what kind of hallucinogenic crap that ink is made of, but I'm pretty sure it would boil off in 1/90th of an atmosphere. I'm using old parts of the antenna array to hold the cards up. There's a certain irony in that. We'll need to talk faster than yes-no questions every half hour. The camera can rotate 360 degrees, and I have plenty of antenna parts. Time to make an alphabet. But I can't just use the letters A through Z. With my question card, that would be 27 cards around the lander. Each one would only get 13 degrees of arc. Even if JPL points the camera perfectly, there's a good chance I won't know which letter they meant. So I'll have to use ASC2. That's how computers manage characters. Each character has a numerical code between 0 and 255. Values between 0 and 255 can be expressed as two hexadecimal digits. By giving me pairs of hex digits, they can send any character they like, including numbers, punctuation, etc. How do I know which values go with which characters? Because Johansson's laptop is a wealth of information. I knew she'd have an ASC2 table in there somewhere. All computer geeks do. So I'll make cards for 0 through 9 and A through F. That makes 16 cards to place around the camera, plus the question card. 17 cards means over 21 degrees each. Much easier to deal with. Time to get to work. Spell with ASC2. Numbers 0 through F at 21 degree increments. We'll watch camera starting 11 o'clock my time. When message done, return to this position. Wait 20 minutes after completion to take picture, so I can write and post reply. Repeat process at top of every hour.
S-T-A-T-U-S. No physical problems. All HAB components functional. Eating 3/4 rations. Successfully growing crops in HAB with cultivated soil. Note. Situation not Ares 3 crew's fault. Bad luck.
H-O-W-A-L-I-V-E. Impaled by antenna fragment, knocked out by decompression, landed face down, blood sealed hole. Woke up after crew left. Biomonitor computer destroyed by puncture. Crew had reason to think me dead. Not their fault. C-R-O-P-S? Long story. Extreme botany. Have 126 meters squared farmland growing potatoes. Will extend food supply, but not enough to last until Ares IV landing. Modified rover for long distance travel. Plan to drive to Ares IV. WESAW-SATLITE. Government watching me with satellites? Need tinfoil hat. Also need faster way to communicate. Speak and spell taking all damn day. Any ideas? BRINGSJRNROUT. Sojourner rover brought out, placed 1 meter due north of lander. If you can contact it, I can draw hex numbers on the wheels, and you can send me 6 bytes at a time. SJRNROTRSPND. Damn. Any other ideas? Need faster communication. WORKINGONIT. Earth is about to set. Resume 0800 my time tomorrow morning. Tell family I'm fine. Give crew my best. Tell Commander Lewis, disco sucks.
I was up all night, said Venkat. Forgive me if I'm a little punchy. Who are you again?
Jack Trevor, said the thin, pale man before Venkat. I work in software engineering.
What can I do for you?
We have an idea for communication.
I'm all ears.
We've been looking through the old Pathfinder software. We got duplicate computers up and running for testing. Same computers they used to find a problem that almost killed the original mission. Real interesting story, actually. Turns out there was a priority inversion in Sojourner's thread management and...
Focus, Jack, interrupted Venkat.
Right. Well, the thing is, Pathfinder has an OS update process, so we can change the software to anything we want.
Okay, how does this help us?
Pathfinder has 2 communication systems. One to talk to us, the other to talk to Sojourner. We can change the second system to broadcast on the Ares III rover frequency, and we can have it pretend to be the beacon signal from the HAB.
You can get Pathfinder talking to Mark's rover?
It's the only option. The HAB's radio is dead. Thing is, all the rover does is triangulate the signal to fix its location. It doesn't send data back to the HAB, it just has a voice channel for the astronauts to talk to each other.
So, Venkat said, you can get Pathfinder talking to the rover, but you can't get the rover talking back.
Right. What we want is for our text to show up on the rover screen and whatever Watney types to be sent back to us. That requires a change to the rover software.
And we can't do that, Venkat concluded, because we can't talk to the rover.
Not directly, Jack said. But we can send data to Watney and have him enter it into the rover.
How much data are we talking about?
I have guys working on the rover software right now. The patch file will be 20 meg, minimum. We can send 1 byte to Watney every 4 seconds or so with this speaking spell. It'd take 3 years of constant broadcasting to get that patch across, so that's no good.
But you're talking to me, so you have a solution, right? Venkat probed.
Of course, Jack beamed.
Software engineers are sneaky bastards when it comes to data management.
Enlighten me, said Venkat patiently.
Here's the clever part, Jack said conspiratorially. The rover currently parses the signal into bytes, then identifies the specific sequence the hab sends. That way, natural radio waves won't throw off the homing. If the bytes aren't right, the rover ignores them.
Okay, so what?
It means there's a spot in the code base where it's got the parsed bytes. We can insert a tiny bit of code, just 20 instructions, to write the parsed bytes to a log file before checking their validity.
This sounds promising, Venkat said.
It is, Jack said excitedly. First, we update Pathfinder with our replacement OS. Then, we tell Watney exactly how to hack the rover software to add those 20 instructions. Then we broadcast the rover's patch to Pathfinder, which rebroadcasts it to the rover. The rover logs the bytes to a file. Finally, Watney launches the file as an executable, and it patches the rover software.
Venkat furrowed his brow, taking in far more information than his sleep-deprived mind wanted to accept.
Jack said, you're not cheering or dancing.
So we just need to send Watney those 20 instructions? Venkat asked.
That and how to edit the files, and where to insert the instructions in the files.
Just like that?
Just like that.
Venkat was silent for a moment.
Jack, I'm going to buy your whole team autographed Star Trek memorabilia.
I prefer Star Wars.
Hello?
I need a picture of Watney.
Hi, Annie. Nice to hear from you, too. How are things back in Houston?
Cut the shit, Venkat. I need a picture.
It's not that simple, Venkat explained.
You're talking to him with a fucking camera. How hard can it be?
We spell out our message, wait 20 minutes, and then take a picture. Watney's back in the hab by then.
So tell him to be around when you take the next picture, Annie demanded.
We can only send one message per hour, and only when Acidalia Planitia is facing Earth, Venkat said. We're not going to waste a message just to tell him to pose for a photo. Besides, he'll be in his EVA suit. You won't even be able to see his face.
I need something, Venkat, Annie said. You've been in contact for 24 hours and the media is going apeshit. They want an image for the story. It'll be on every news site in the world.
You have the pictures of his notes. Make do with that.
Not enough, Annie said. The press is crawling down my throat for this, and up my ass. Both directions, Venkat. They're gonna meet in the middle.
It'll have to wait a few days. We're going to try and link Pathfinder to the rover computer.
A few days? Annie gasped. This is all anyone cares about right now, in the world. You see what I'm getting at? This is the biggest story since Apollo 13. Give me a fucking picture!
Venkat sighed.
I'll try to get it tomorrow.
Great, she said. Looking forward to it.
Log entry. Sol 98. I have to be watching the camera when it spells shit out. It's half a byte at a time. So I watch a pair of numbers, then look them up on an ASC2 cheat sheet I made. That's one letter. I don't want to forget any letter, so I scrape them into the dirt with a rod. The process of looking up a letter and scraping it in the dirt takes a couple of seconds. Sometimes, when I look back at the camera, I've missed a number. I can usually guess it from context, but other times I just miss out. Today I got up hours earlier than I needed to. It was like Christmas morning. I could hardly wait for 0800 to roll around. I had breakfast, did some unnecessary checks on hab equipment, and read some Poirot. Finally, the time came. CNHAKRVR2TLK2PTHFDR. PRP4LONGMSG. Yeah, took me a minute. Can hack rover to talk to Pathfinder. Prepare for long message. That took some mental gymnastics to work out, but it was great news. If we could get that set up, we'd only be limited by transmission time.
I set up a note that said, Roger. Not sure what they meant by long message, but I figured I'd better be ready. I went out 15 minutes before the top of the hour and smoothed out a big area of dirt. I found the longest antenna rod I had so I could reach into the smooth area without having to step on it. Then I stood by, waiting. At exactly the top of the hour, the message came. LNCHEXIDITONRVRCMP, LNCRVRCMP, OPENFILE DASH SCROLLTIL STPNXTMSG, COLON 2AAE5, OVRWRT 141BYTS WTH DATA, WE, APOSTROPHE LL SND NXT MSG, COMMA OVRWRT 141BYTS WTH DATA, WE, APOSTROPHE LL SND NXT MSG, COMMA STANDD, IN, JESUS,
They want me to launch HexEdit on the rover's computer, then open the file /user/library/habcom.so. Scroll until the index reading on the left of the screen is 2AAE5, then replace the bytes there with a 141-byte sequence NASA will send in the next message. Fair enough. Also, for some reason, they want me to hang around for the next pick. Not sure why. You can't see any part of me when I'm in the suit. Even the faceplate would reflect too much light. Still, it's what they want. I went back in and copied down the message for future reference. Then I wrote a short note and came back out. Usually I'd pin up the note and go back in, but this time I had to hang around for a photo op. I gave the camera a thumbs up to go along with my note, which said, "Hey," blamed the 70s TV.
"I ask for a picture, and I get the fonz," Annie admonished.
"You got your picture, quit bitching," Venkat said, cradling the phone on his shoulder.
He paid more attention to the schematics in front of him than the conversation.
"Hey," Annie mocked. "Why would he do that?"
"Have you met Mark Watney?"
"Fine, fine," Annie said, "but I want a pic of his face ASAP.
"Can't do that."
"Why not?"
"Because if he takes off his helmet, he'll die."
"Annie, I have to go. One of the JPL programmers is here, and it's urgent. Bye." "But," Annie said as he hung up.
Jack, in the doorway, said,
"It's not urgent."
"Yeah, I know," Venkat said. "What can I do for you?"
"We were thinking," Jack began. "This rover hack might get kind of detailed. We may have to do a bunch of back-and-forth communication with Watney."
"That's fine," Venkat said. "Take your time. Do it right."
"We could get things done faster with a shorter transmission time," Jack said.
Venkat gave him a puzzled look.
"Do you have a plan for moving Earth and Mars close together?"
"Earth doesn't have to be involved," Jack said. "Hermes is 73 million kilometers from Mars right now, only 4 light minutes away. Beth Johansson is a great programmer. She could talk Mark through it."
"Out of the question," Venkat said.
"She's the mission psysop," Jack pressed on. "This is her exact area of expertise."
"Can't do it, Jack. The crew still doesn't know."
"What is with you? Why won't you just tell them?"
"Watney's not my only responsibility," Venkat said. "I've got 5 other astronauts in deep space who have to concentrate on their return trip. Nobody thinks about it, but statistically, they're in more danger than Watney right now. He's on a planet, They're in space. Jack raised his arms. Fine. We'll do it the slow way.
Log entry. Sol 98, 2. Ever transcribed 141 random bytes, one half of a byte at a time? It's boring, and it's tricky when you don't have a pen. Earlier, I had just written letters in the sand, but this time I needed a way to get the numbers onto something portable. My first plan was use a laptop. Each crewman had their own laptop, so I have six at my disposal. Rather, I had six. I now have five. I thought a laptop would be fine outside. It's just electronics, right? It'll keep warm enough to operate in the short term, and it doesn't need air for anything. It died instantly. The screen went black before I was out of the airlock. Turns out the L in LCD stands for liquid. I guess it either froze or boiled off. Maybe I'll post a consumer review. Brought product to surface of Mars. It stopped working. 0 out of 10. So I used a camera. I've got lots of them, specially made for working on Mars. I wrote the bytes in the sand as they came in, took a picture, then transcribed them in the HAB. It's night now, so no more messages. Tomorrow I'll enter this into the rover, and the geeks at JPL can take it from there.
Come on up here, Jack, said Venkat. You get to be the most Tim-word today.
Thanks, said Jack, taking Venkat's place next to Tim.
Hey, you, Tim?
Jack, said Tim.
How long will the patch take? Venkat asked.
Should be pretty much instant, Jack answered. Watney entered the hack earlier today and we confirmed it worked. We updated Pathfinder's OS without any problems, and we sent the rover patch, which Pathfinder rebroadcast. Once Watney executes the patch and reboots the rover, we should get a connection.
Jesus, what a complicated process, Venkat said.
Try updating a Linux server sometime, Jack said.
After a moment of silence, Tim said, You know he was telling a joke, right? That was supposed to be funny.
Oh, said Venkat. I'm a physics guy, not a computer guy.
He's not funny to computer guys either.
You're a very unpleasant man, Tim, Jack said.
Systems online, said Tim.
What?
It's online, FYI.
Holy crap, Jack said.
It worked,
Venkat announced to the room. 1118 hours. JPL. Mark, this is Venkat Kapoor. We've been watching you since Sol 49. The whole world's been rooting for you. Amazing job getting Pathfinder. We're working on rescue plans. JPL is adjusting Ares 4's MDV to do a short overland flight. They'll pick you up, then take you with them to Schiaparelli. We're putting together a supply mission to keep you fed till Ares 4 arrives. 1129 hours. Watney. Glad to hear it. Really looking forward to not dying. I want to make it clear it wasn't the crew's fault. Side question. What did they say when they found out I was alive? Also, hi, Mom. 1141 hours. JPL. Tell us about your crops. We estimated your food packs would last until Sol 400 at 3/4 ration per meal. Will your crops affect that number? As to your question, we haven't told the crew you're alive yet. We wanted them to concentrate on their own mission. 1152 hours. Watney. The crops are potatoes, grown from the ones we were supposed to prepare on Thanksgiving. They're doing great, but the available farmland isn't enough for sustainability. I'll run out food around Sol 900. Also, tell the crew I'm alive. What the fuck is wrong with you? 1200 hours, 4 minutes. JPL. We'll get botanists in to ask detailed questions and double-check your work. Your life is at stake, so we want to be sure. Sol 900 is great news. It'll give us a lot more time to get the supply mission together. Also, please watch your language. Everything you type is being broadcast live all over the world. 1200 hours, 15 minutes. Watney.
Boobies.
Thank you, Mr. President,
Teddy said into the phone. I appreciate the call, and I'll pass your congratulations on to the whole organization. Hanging up, he saw Mitch Henderson in the doorway.
This a good time?
Mitch asked.
Come in, Mitch, Teddy said. Have a seat.
Thanks, Mitch said, sitting in a fine leather couch.
Good day today?
Yes, it was, Teddy agreed. Another step closer to getting Watney back alive.
Yeah, about that, said Mitch. You probably know why I'm here.
I can take a guess, said Teddy.
You want to tell the crew Watney's alive?
Yes, Mitch said.
And you're bringing this up with me while Venkat is in Pasadena, so he can't argue the other side.
I shouldn't have to clear this with you or Venkat or anyone else. I'm the flight director. It should have been my call from the beginning, but you two stepped in and overrode me. Ignoring all that, we agreed we'd tell them when there was hope, and now there's hope. We've got communication, we have a plan for rescue in the works, and his farm buys us enough time to get him supplies.
Okay, tell them, Teddy said.
Mitch paused.
Just like that?
I knew you'd be here sooner or later, so I already thought it through and decided. Go ahead and tell them.
Mitch stood up.
All right. Thanks, he said as he left the office.
Teddy swiveled in his chair and looked out his windows to the night sky. He pondered the faint red dot amongst the stars.
Hang in there, Watney, he said to no one. We're coming.
Chapter 12. Watney slept peacefully in his bunk. He shifted slightly as some pleasant dream put a smile on his face. The previous day had been particularly labor-intensive, so he slept deeper and better than he had in a long time.
"Good morning, crew," Lewis called out. "It's a brand new day. Up and at 'em."
Watney added his voice to a chorus of groans.
"Come on," Lewis prodded. "No bitching. You got 40 minutes more sleep than you would have on Earth."
Martinez was first out of his bunk. An Air Force man, he could match Lewis's Navy schedule with ease.
"Morning, Commander," he said crisply.
Johansson sat up but made no further move toward the harsh world outside her blankets. A career software engineer, mornings were never her forte. Vogel slowly lumbered from his bunk, checking his watch. He wordlessly pulled on his jumpsuit, smoothing out what wrinkles he could. He sighed inwardly at the grimy feeling of another day without a shower. Watney turned away from the noise, hugging a pillow to his head.
"Noisy people go away," he mumbled.
"Beck,"
Martinez called out, shaking the mission's doctor.
"Rise and shine, bud."
"Yeah, okay,"
Beck said blearily. Johansson fell out of her bunk, then remained on the floor. Pulling the pillow from Watney's hands, Lewis said,
"Let's move, Watney. Uncle Sam paid $100,000 for every second we'll be here."
"Bad woman, take pillow,"
Watney groaned, unwilling to open his eyes.
"Back on Earth, I've tipped 200-pound men out of their bunks. Want to see what I can do in 0.4 gravity?"
"No, not really,"
Watney said, sitting up. Having rousted the troops, Lewis sat at the comm station to check overnight messages from Houston. Watney shuffled to the ration cupboard and grabbed a breakfast at random.
"Hand me an eggs, will ya?"
Martinez said.
"You can tell the difference," Watney said, passing Martinez a pack.
"Not really,"
Martinez said.
"Beck, what'll you have?"
Watney continued.
"Don't care," Beck said. "Give me whatever."
Watney tossed a pack to him.
"Vogel, your usual sausages?"
"Ja, please," Vogel responded.
"You know you're a stereotype, right?"
"I am comfortable with that,"
Vogel replied, taking the proffered breakfast.
"Hey, sunshine," Watney called to Johansson. "Eating breakfast today?"
Johansson grunted.
"Pretty sure that's a no," Watney guessed.
The crew ate in silence. Johansson eventually trudged to the ration cupboard and got a coffee packet. Clumsily adding hot water, she sipped it until wakefulness crept in.
"Mission updates from Houston," Lewis said. "Satellites show a storm coming, but we can do surface ops before it gets here. Vogel, Martinez, you'll be with me outside. Johansson, you're stuck tracking weather reports. Watney, your soil experiments are bumped up to today.
Beck run the samples from yesterday's EVA through the spectrometer.
Should you really go out with a storm on the way?
Beck asked. Houston authorized it, Lewis said.
Seems needlessly dangerous.
Coming to Mars was needlessly dangerous, Lewis said. What's your point?
Beck shrugged. Just be careful.
Three figures looked eastward. Their bulky EVA suits rendered them nearly identical. Only the European Union flag on Vogel's shoulder distinguished him from Lewis and Martinez, who donned the stars and stripes. The darkness to the east undulated and flickered in the rays of the rising sun.
"The storm," Vogel said in his accented English. "It is closer than Houston reported."
"We've got time," Lewis said. "Focus on the task at hand. This EVA's all about chemical analysis. Vogel, you're the chemist, so you're in charge of what we dig up."
"Yeah," Vogel said. "Please dig 30 centimeters and get soil samples. At least 100 grams each. Very important is 30 centimeters down."
"Will do," Lewis said. "Stay within 100 meters of the hab," she added. Vogel said.
"Yes, ma'am," said Martinez.
They split up. Greatly improved since the days of Apollo, Ares' EVA suits allowed much more freedom of motion. Digging, bending over, and bagging samples were trivial tasks. After a time, Lewis asked, "How many samples do you need?"
7 each, perhaps.
"That's fine," Lewis confirmed. "I've got 4 so far."
5 here," Martinez said.
"Of course, we can't expect the Navy to keep up with the Air Force now, can we?"
"So that's how you want to play it," Lewis said.
"Just call him as I see him, Commander."
"Johansson here," came the Psysop's voice over the radio. "Houston's upgraded the storm to severe. It's going to be here in 15 minutes.
Back to base," Lewis said. The hab shook in the roaring wind as the astronauts huddled in the center. All 6 donned their EVA suits in case of a breach. Johansson watched her laptop while the rest watched her.
"Sustained winds over 100 kilometers per hour now," she said. "Gusting to 125.
"Jesus, we're going to end up in Oz," Watney said.
"What's the abort wind speed?"
"Technically 150 kilometers per hour," Martinez said. "Any more than that and the MAV's in danger of tipping."
"Any predictions on the storm track?" Lewis asked.
"This is the edge of it," Johansson said, staring at her screen. "It's going to get worse before it gets better."
The hab canvas rippled under the brutal assault as the internal supports bent and shivered with each gust. The cacophony grew louder by the minute. "All right," Lewis said. "Prep for abort. We'll go to the MAV and hope for the best. If the wind gets too high, we'll launch." Leaving the hab in pairs, they grouped outside Airlock 1. The driving wind and sand battered them, but they were able to stay on their feet.
"Visibility is almost zero," Lewis said. "If you get lost, home in on my suit's telemetry. The wind's going to be rougher away from the hab, so be ready."
Pressing through the gale, they stumbled toward the MAV.
"Hey," Watney panted, "maybe we could shore up the MAV, make tipping less likely."
"How?" Lewis huffed.
"We could use cables from the solar farm as guy lines."
He wheezed for a few moments, then continued.
"The rovers could be anchors. The trick would be getting the line around the..."
Flying wreckage slammed Watney, carrying him off into the wind.
"Watney!"
Johansson exclaimed.
"What happened?" Lewis said.
"Something hit him," Johansson reported.
"Watney, report," Lewis said.
No reply.
"Watney, report," Lewis repeated.
Again, she was met with silence.
"He's offline," Johansson reported. "I don't know where he is."
"Commander," Beck said. "Before we lost telemetry, his decompression alarm went off."
"Shit," Lewis exclaimed. "Johansson, where did you last see him?" "He was right in front of me, and then he was gone," she said. "He flew off due west."
"Okay," Lewis said. "Martinez, get to the MAV and prep for launch. Everyone else, home in on Johansson."
"Dr. Beck,"
Vogel said as he stumbled through the storm.
"How long can a person survive decompression?"
"Less than a minute," Beck said, emotion choking his voice.
"I can't see anything," Johansson said as the crew crowded around her.
"Line up and walk west," Lewis commanded. "Small steps. He's probably prone. We don't want to step over him."
Staying in sight of one another, they trudged through the chaos.
Martinez fell into the MAV airlock and forced it closed against the wind. Once it pressurized, he quickly doffed his suit. Climbing the ladder to the crew compartment, he slid into the pilot's couch and booted the system. Grabbing the emergency launch checklist with one hand, he flicked switches rapidly with the other. One by one, the systems reported flight-ready status. As they came online, he noticed one in particular.
"Commander," he radioed, "the MAV's got a 7-degree tilt. It'll tip at 12.3.
"Copy that," Lewis said.
"Johansson,"
Beck said, looking at his arm computer. "Watney's biomonitor sent something before going offline. My computer just says bad packet."
"I have it too," Johansson said. "It didn't finish transmitting. Some data's missing and there's no checksum. Give me a sec."
"Commander," Martinez said, "message from Houston. We are officially scrubbed. The storm's definitely going to be too rough."
"Copy," Lewis said.
"They sent that 4.5 minutes ago," Martinez continued, "while looking at satellite data from 9 minutes ago."
"Understood," Lewis said. "Continue prepping for launch."
"Copy," Martinez said.
"Beck," Johansson said, "I have the raw packet. It's plain text BP0PR0TP36.2. That's as far as it got."
"Copy," Beck said morosely. "Blood pressure 0, pulse rate 0, temperature normal."
The channel fell silent for some time. They continued pressing forward, shuffling through the sandstorm, hoping for a miracle.
"Temperature normal?" Lewis said, a hint of hope in her voice.
"It takes a while for the—" Beck stammered. "It takes a while to cool."
"Commander," Martinez said, "tilting at 10.5 degrees now, with gusts pushing it to 11.
"Copy," Lewis said.
"Are you at pilot release?"
"Affirmative," Martinez replied. "I can launch any time."
"If it tips, can you launch before it falls completely over?"
Martinez said, not expecting the question.
"Yes, ma'am. I'd take manual control and go full throttle. Then I'd nose up and return to pre-programmed descent."
"Copy that," Lewis said.
"Everyone home in on Martinez's suit. That'll get you to the MAV airlock. Get in and prep for launch."
"What about you, Commander?" Beck asked.
"I'm searching a little more. Get moving. And Martinez, if you start to tip, launch."
"You really think I'll leave you behind?" Martinez said.
"I just ordered you to," Lewis replied.
"You three, get to the ship."
They reluctantly obeyed Lewis's order and made their way toward the MAV. The punishing wind fought them every step of the way. Unable to see the ground, Lewis shuffled forward. Remembering something, she reached to her back and got a pair of rock drill bits. She had added the 1-meter bits to her equipment that morning, anticipating geological sampling later in the day. Holding one in each hand, she dragged them along the ground as she walked. After 20 meters, she turned around and walked the opposite direction. Walking a straight line proved to be impossible. Not only did she lack visual references, the endless wind pushed her off course. The sheer volume of attacking sand buried her feet with each step. Grunting, she pressed on. Beck, Johansson, and Vogel squeezed into the MAV airlock. Designed for two, it could be used by three in emergencies. As it equalized, Lewis's voice came over the radio.
"Johansson," she said, "would the Rover IR camera do any good?" "Negative," Johansson replied. "IR can't get through sand any better than visible light."
"What's she thinking?" Beck asked after removing his helmet. "She's a geologist. She knows IR can't get through a sandstorm."
"She is grasping," Vogel said, opening the inner door. "We must get to the couches. Please hurry."
"I don't feel good about this," Beck said.
"Neither do I, Doctor," said Vogel, climbing the ladder. "But the commander has given us orders. Insubordination will not help."
"Commander," Martinez radioed, "we're tilting 11.6 degrees. One good gust and we're tipping."
"What about the proximity radar?" Lewis said. "Could it detect Watney's suit?"
"No way," Martinez said. "It's made to see Hermes in orbit, not the metal in a single spacesuit."
"Give it a try," Lewis said.
"Commander,"
said Beck, putting on a headset as he slid into his acceleration couch.
"I know you don't want to hear this, but Watney... Mark's dead."
"Copy," Lewis said.
"Martinez, try the radar."
"Roger,"
Martinez radioed. Bringing the radar online, he waited for it to complete a self-check. Glaring at Beck, he said,
"What's the matter with you?"
"My friend just died," Beck answered, "and I don't want my commander to die too." Martinez gave him a stern look. Turning his attention back to the radar, he radioed, "Negative contact on proximity radar."
"Nothing?"
Lewis asked. "It can barely see the HAB," he replied. "The sandstorm's fucking things up. Even if it wasn't, there's not enough metal in..."
"Shit! Strap in!"
he yelled to the crew.
"We're tipping!"
The MAV began creaking as it tilted faster and faster.
13 degrees,
Johansson called out from her couch. Buckling his restraints, Vogel said, "We are far past the balance. We will not rock back."
"We can't leave her," Beck yelled. "Let it tip. We'll fix it."
32 metric tons, including fuel, Martinez said, his hands flying over the controls. "If it hits the ground, it'll do structural damage to the tanks, frame, and probably the second stage engine. We'd never be able to fix it."
"You can't abandon her," Beck said. "You can't!"
"I've got one trick. If that doesn't work, I'm following her orders." Bringing the orbital maneuvering system online, he fired a sustained burn from the nose cone array. The small thrusters fought against the lumbering mass of the slowly tilting spacecraft.
"You're firing the OMS?" Vogel asked.
"I don't know if it'll work. We're not tipping very fast," Martinez said.
"I think it's slowing down." "The aerodynamic caps will have automatically ejected," Vogel said. "It will be a bumpy ascent with three holes in the side of the ship."
"Thanks for the tip," Martinez said, maintaining the burn and watching the tilt readout.
"Come on."
"Still 13 degrees, Johansson reported. "What's going on up there?" Lewis radioed. "You went quiet. Respond."
"Stand by,"
Martinez replied.
12.9 degrees, Johansson said.
"It is working," Vogel said.
"For now," Martinez said. "I don't know if maneuvering fuel will last."
12.8 now, Johansson supplied.
"OMS fuel at 60%, Beck said. "How much do you need to dock with Hermes?"
10% if I don't fuck anything up,
Martinez said, adjusting the thrust angle.
12.6, Johansson said. "We're tipping back."
"Or the wind died down a little," Beck postulated. "Fuel at 45%.
"There is danger of damage to the vents," Vogel cautioned. "The OMS was not made for prolonged thrusts."
"I know," Martinez said. "I can dock without nose vents if I have to."
"Almost there," Johansson said.
"Okay, we're under 12.3. OMS cut off," Martinez announced, terminating the burn.
"Still tipping back," Johansson said.
11.6.
11.5.
"Holding at 11.5.
OMS fuel at 22%, Beck said.
"Yeah, I see that," Martinez replied. "It'll be enough."
"Commander," Beck radioed, "you need to get to the ship now."
"Agreed," Martinez radioed.
"He's gone, ma'am. Watney's gone."
The four crewmates awaited their commander's response.
"Copy," she finally replied. "On my way."
They lay in silence, strapped to their couches and ready for launch. Beck looked at Watney's empty couch and saw Vogel doing the same. Martinez ran a self-check on the nose cone OMS thrusters. They were no longer safe for use. He noted the malfunction in his log. The airlock cycled. After removing her suit, Lewis made her way to the flight cabin. She wordlessly strapped into her couch, her face a frozen mask. Only Martinez dared speak.
"Still at pilot release," he said quietly. "Ready for launch?"
Lewis closed her eyes and nodded.
"I'm sorry, Commander," Martinez said. "You need to verbally
launch," she said.
"Yes, ma'am,"
he replied, activating the sequence. The retaining clamps ejected from the launch gantry, falling to the ground. Seconds later, pre-ignition pyros fired, igniting the main engines, and the MAV lurched upward. The ship slowly gained speed. As it did, wind shear blew it laterally off course. Sensing the problem, the ascent software angled the ship into the wind to counteract it. As fuel was consumed, the ship got lighter and the acceleration more pronounced. Rising at this exponential rate, the craft quickly reached maximum acceleration, a limit defined not by the ship's power, but by the delicate human bodies inside. As the ship soared, the open OMS ports took their toll. The crew rocked in their couches as the craft shook violently. Martinez and the ascent software kept it trim, though it was a constant battle. The turbulence tapered off and eventually fell to nothing as the atmosphere became thinner and thinner. Suddenly, all force stopped. The first stage had completed. The crew experienced weightlessness for several seconds, then were pressed back into their couches as the next stage began. Outside, the now-empty first stage fell away, eventually to crash on some unknown area of the planet below. The second stage pushed the ship ever higher and into low orbit. Lasting less time than the massive first stage and running much smoother, it seemed almost like an afterthought. Abruptly, the engine stopped and an oppressive calm replaced the previous cacophony.
"Main engine shut down," Martinez said. "Ascent time 8:14. On course for Hermes intercept."
Normally, an incident-free launch would be cause for celebration. This one earned only silence, broken by Johansson's gentle sobbing. 4 months later. NASA was loath to waste research time. Trips to and from Mars were as busy as surface operations. The crew had almost caught up with the backlog of work. The schedule had been made for 6, not 5. Beck tried not to think about the painful reason he was doing zero-G plant growth experiments. He noted the size and shape of the fern leaves, took photos, and made notes. Having completed his science schedule for the day, he checked his watch. Perfect timing. The data dump would be completing soon. He floated past the reactor to the semicone A ladder. Traveling feet first along the ladder, he soon had to grip it in earnest as the centripetal force of the rotating ship took hold. By the time he reached semicone A, he was at 0.4 gravity. No mere luxury, the artificial gravity kept them fit. Without it, they would have spent their first week on Mars barely able to walk. Exercise regimens could keep the heart and bones healthy, but none had been devised that would give them full function from Sol 1. Because the ship was already designed for it, they used the system on the return trip as well. Johansson sat at her station. Lewis sat in the adjacent seat while Vogel and Martinez hovered nearby. The data dump carried emails and videos from home. It was the high point of the day.
"Is it here yet?" Beck asked as he entered the bridge.
"Almost," Johansson said. 98%.
"You're looking cheerful, Martinez," Beck said.
"My son turned 3 yesterday," he beamed. "Should be some pics of the party. How about you?"
"Nothing special," Beck said. "Peer reviews of a paper I wrote a few years back."
"Complete," Johansson said. "All the personal emails are dispatched to your laptops. Also, there's a telemetry update for Vogel and a system update for me."
"Huh.
There's a voice message addressed to the whole crew." She looked over her shoulder to Lewis. Lewis shrugged. "Play it."
Johansson opened the message, then sat back.
"Hermes, this is Mitch Henderson," the message began.
"Henderson?" Martinez said, puzzled. "Talking directly to us without Capcom?" Lewis held her hand up to signal for silence.
"I have some news," Mitch's voice continued. "There's no subtle way to put this. Mark Watney's still alive."
Johansson gasped. "Wah," Beck stammered. Vogel stood agape as a shocked expression swept across his face. Martinez looked to Lewis. She leaned forward and pinched her chin.
"I know that's a surprise," Mitch continued, "and I know you'll have a lot of questions. We're going to answer those questions. But for now, I'll just give you the basics. He's alive and healthy. We found out 2 months ago and decided not to tell you. We even censored personal messages. I was strongly against all that. We're telling you now because we finally have communication with him and a viable rescue plan. It boils down to Ares 4 picking him up with a modified MDV. We'll get you a full write-up of what happened, but it's definitely not your fault. Mark stresses that every time it comes up. It was just bad luck. Take some time to absorb this. Your science schedules are cleared for tomorrow. Send all the questions you want, and we'll answer them. Henderson out."
The message's end brought stunned silence to the bridge.
He's alive," Martinez said, then smiled. Vogel nodded excitedly.
"He lives?"
Johansson stared at her screen in wide-eyed disbelief.
"Holy shit!" Beck laughed. "Holy shit, Commander, he's alive!"
"I left him behind," Lewis said quietly. The celebrations ceased immediately as the crew saw their commander's inconsolable expression.
"But," Beck began,
"we all left to get—" "You followed orders," Lewis interrupted. "I left him behind, in a barren, unreachable, godforsaken wasteland.
Beck looked to Martinez pleadingly. Martinez opened his mouth, but could find no words to say.
Lewis trudged off the bridge.
Chapter 13. The employees of Deo Plastics worked double shifts. There was talk of triple shifts if NASA increased the order again. No one minded. The overtime pay was spectacular and the funding was limitless. Woven carbon thread ran slowly through the press, which sandwiched it between polymer sheets. The completed material was folded four times and glued together. The resulting thick sheet was then coated with soft resin and taken to the hot room to set. Log entry, Sol 114.
Now that NASA can talk to me, they won't shut the hell up. They want constant updates on every HAB system, and they've got a full room of people trying to micromanage my crops. It's awesome to have a bunch of dipshits on Earth telling me, a botanist, how to grow plants. I mostly ignore them. I don't want to come off as arrogant here, but I'm the best botanist on the planet. One big bonus? Email. Just like the days back on Hermes, I get data dumps. Of course, they relay email from friends and family, but NASA also sends along choice messages from the public. I've gotten email from rock stars, athletes, actors and actresses, and even the president. The coolest one is from my alma mater, the University of Chicago. They say once you grow crops somewhere, you have officially colonized it. So technically, I colonized Mars.
In your face, Neil Armstrong!
I go to the rover five times a day to check mail. They can get a message from Earth to Mars, but they can't get it another 10 meters to the HAB. But hey, I can't bitch. My odds of living through this are way higher now. Last I heard, they solved the weight problem on Ares IV's MDV. Once it lands here, they'll ditch the heat shield, all the life support stuff, and a bunch of empty fuel tanks. Then they can take the seven of us, Ares IV's crew, plus me, all the way to Schiaparelli. They're already working on my duties for the surface ops. How cool is that? In other news, I'm learning Morse code. Why? Because it's our backup communication system. NASA figured a decades-old probe isn't idea as a sole means of communication. If Pathfinder craps out, I'll spell messages with rocks, which NASA will see with satellites. They can't reply, but at least we'd have one-way communication. Why Morse code? Because making dots and dashes with rocks is a lot easier than making letters. It's a shitty way to communicate. Hopefully it won't come up.
All chemical reactions complete. The sheet was sterilized and moved to a clean room. There, a worker cut a strip off the edge. Dividing the strip into squares, he put each through a series of rigorous tests. Having passed inspection, the sheet was then cut to shape. The edges were folded over, sewn, and resealed with resin. A man with a clipboard made final inspections, independently verifying the measurements, then approved it for use. Log entry, Sol 115.
The meddling botanists have grudgingly admitted I did a good job. They agree I'll have enough food to last till Sol 900. Bearing that in mind, NASA has fleshed out the mission details of the supply probe. At first, they were working on a desperate plan to get a probe here before Sol 400. But I bought another 500 souls of life with my potato farm, so they have more time to work on it. They'll launch next year during the Hohmann transfer window, and it'll take almost 9 months to get here. It should arrive around Sol 856. It'll have plenty of food, a spare oxygenator, water reclaimer, and comm system. 3 comm systems, actually. I guess they aren't taking any chances, what with my habit of being nearby when radios break. Got my first email from Hermes today. NASA's been limiting direct contact. I guess they're afraid I'll say something like, "You abandoned me on Mars, you fuckwits!" I know the crew is surprised to hear from the ghost of Mars missions past, but come on. I wish NASA was less of a nanny sometimes. Anyway, they finally let one email through from Martinez. "Dear Watney, sorry we left you behind, but we don't like you. You're sort of a smartass, and it's a lot roomier on Hermes without you. We have to take turns doing your tasks, but it's only botany, not real science, so it's easy. How's Mars?" Martinez. My reply,
Dear Martinez, Mars is fine. When I get lonely, I think of that steamy night I spent with your mom. How are things on Hermes? Cramped and claustrophobic? Yesterday I went outside and looked at the vast horizons. I tell you, Martinez, they go on forever. Watney. The employees carefully folded the sheet and placed it in an argon-filled airtight shipping container. Printing out a sticker, the man with the clipboard placed it on the package. Project Ares 3. Hab Canvas. Sheet AL-102. The package was placed on a charter plane and flown to Edwards Air Force Base in California. It flew abnormally high at great cost of fuel to ensure a smoother flight. Upon arrival, the package was carefully transported by special convoy to Pasadena. Once there, it was moved to the JPL White Room for probe assembly. Over the next 5 weeks, engineers in white body suits assembled Pre-Supply 309. It contained AL-102, as well as 12 other HAB Canvas packages. Log Entry, Sol 116.
It's almost time for the second harvest. Yep. I wish I had a straw hat and some suspenders. My reseed of the potatoes went well. I'm beginning to see that crops on Mars are extremely prolific, thanks to the billions of dollars worth of life support equipment around me. I now have 400 healthy potato plants, each one making lots of calorie-filled taters for my dining enjoyment. In just 10 days, they'll be ripe. And this time, I'm not replanting them as seed. This is my food supply. All natural, organic, Martian-grown potatoes. Don't hear that every day, do you? You may be wondering how I'll store them. I can't just pile them up. Most of them would go bad before I got around to eating them. So instead, I'll do something that wouldn't work at all on Earth. Throw them outside. Most of the water will be sucked out by the near vacuum. What's left will freeze solid. Any bacteria planning to rot my taters will die screaming. In other news, I got email from Venkat Kapoor.
Mark, some answers to your earlier questions. No, we will not tell our botany team to go fuck themselves. I understand you've been on your own for a long time, but we're in the loop now, and it's best if you listen to what we have to say. The Cubs finished the season at the bottom of the NL Central. The data transfer rate just isn't good enough for the size of music files, even in compressed formats, so your request for anything, oh God, anything but disco is denied. Enjoy your boogie fever. Also, an uncomfortable side note. NASA is putting together a committee. They want to see if there were any avoidable mistakes that led you to being stranded. Just a heads up. They may have questions for you later on. Keep us posted on your activities. Kapoor.
My reply. Venkat. Tell the investigation committee they'll have to do their witch hunt without me, and when they inevitably blame Commander Lewis, be advised I'll publicly refute it. Also, please tell them that each and every one of their mothers are prostitutes. Watney. P.S. They're sisters, too. The pre-supply probes for Ares 3 launched on 14 consecutive days during the home and transfer window. Pre-supply 309 was launched third. The 251-day trip to Mars was uneventful, needing only two minor course adjustments. After several aero-braking maneuvers to slow down, it made its final descent toward Acidalia Planitia. First, it endured re-entry via a heat shield. Later, it released a parachute and detached the now-expended shield. Once its onboard radar detected it was 30 meters from the ground, it cut loose the parachute and inflated balloons all around its hull. It fell unceremoniously to the surface, bouncing and rolling until it finally came to rest. Deflating its balloons, the onboard computer reported the successful landing back to Earth. Then it waited 23 months. Log Entry, Sol 117. The water reclaimer is acting up. Six people will go through 18 liters of water per day, so it's made to process 20, but lately it hasn't been keeping up. It's doing 10 tops. Do I generate 10 liters of water per day? No, I'm not the urinating champion of all time. It's the crops.
The humidity inside the hab is a lot higher than it was designed for, so the water reclaimer is constantly filtering it out of the air. I'm not worried about it. Water is water. The plants use it, I use it. If need be, I can piss on the plants directly. It'll evaporate and condense on the walls. I could make something to collect it, I'm sure. Thing is, the water can't go anywhere. It's a closed system. Plus, I made like 600 liters from MDV fuel. Remember the explosive hab incident? I could take baths and still have plenty left over. NASA, however, is absolutely shitting itself. They see the water reclaimer as a critical survival element. There's no backup, and they think I'll die instantly without it. To them, equipment failure is terrifying. To me, it's Tuesday. So instead of preparing for my harvest, I have to make extra trips to and from the rover to answer their questions. Each new message instructs me to try some new solution and report the results back. So far, we've worked out it's not the electronics, refrigeration system, instrumentation, or temperature. I'm sure it'll turn out to be a little hole somewhere. Then NASA will have 4 hours of meetings before telling me to cover it with duct tape. Lewis and Beck opened Pre-Supply 309. Working as best they could in their bulky EVA suits, they removed the various portions of hab canvas and laid them on the ground. Three entire pre-supply probes were dedicated to the hab. Following a procedure they had practiced hundreds of times, they efficiently assembled the pieces. Special seal strips between the patches ensured airtight mating. After erecting the main structure of the hab, they assembled the three airlocks. Sheet AL-102 had a hole, perfectly sized for airlock 1. Beck stretched the sheet tight to the seal strips on the airlock's exterior. Once all airlocks were in place, Lewis flooded the hab with air, and AL-102 felt pressure for the first time. They waited an hour. No pressure was lost. The setup had been perfect. Log entry, Sol 118. My conversation with NASA about the water reclaimer was boring and riddled with technical details, so I'll paraphrase it for you. Me, this is obviously a clog. How about I take it apart and check the internal tubing? NASA, after 5 hours of deliberation. No, you'll fuck it up and die. So I took it apart. Yeah, I know. NASA has a lot of ultra-smart people and I should really do what they say. And I'm being too adversarial, considering they spend all day working on how to save my life. I just get sick of being told how to wipe my ass. Independence was one of the things they looked for when choosing Ares astronauts. It's a 13-month mission, most of it spent many light minutes away from Earth. They wanted people who would act on their own initiative, but at the same time obey their commander. If Commander Lewis were here, I'd do whatever she said, no problem. But a committee of faceless bureaucrats back on Earth? Sorry, I'm just having a tough time with it. I was really careful. I labeled every piece as I dismantled it and laid everything out on a table. I have the schematics in the computer, so nothing was a surprise. And just as I suspected, there was a clogged tube. The water reclaimer was designed to purify urine and strain humidity out of the air. You exhale almost as much water as you piss. I've mixed my water with soil, making it mineral water. The minerals built up in the water reclaimer. I cleaned out the tubing and put it all back together. It completely solved the problem. I'll have to do it again someday, but not for 100 sols or so, no big deal. I told NASA what I did. Our, paraphrased, conversation was me. I took it apart, found the problem, and fixed it. NASA. Dick. AL-102 shuddered in the brutal storm. Withstanding forces and pressure far greater than its design, it rippled violently against the airlock seal strip. Other sections of canvas undulated along their seal strips together, acting as a single sheet. But AL-102 had no such luxury. The airlock barely moved, leaving AL-102 to take the full force of the tempest. The layers of plastic, constantly bending, heated the resin from pure friction. The new, more yielding environment allowed the carbon fibers to separate. AL-102 stretched. Not much, only 4 millimeters, but the carbon fibers, usually 500 microns apart,
now had a gap 8 times that width in their midst. After the storm abated, the lone remaining astronaut performed a full inspection of the HAB. But he didn't notice anything amiss. The weak part of canvas was concealed by a seal strip. Designed for a mission of 31 sols, AL-102 continued well past its planned expiration. Sol after sol went by, with the lone astronaut traveling in and out of the HAB almost daily. Airlock 1 was closest to the rover charging station, so the astronaut preferred it to the other two. When pressurized, the airlock expanded slightly. When depressurized, it shrunk. Every time the astronaut used the airlock, the strain on AL-102 relaxed, then tightened anew. Pulling, stressing, weakening, stretching. Log entry, Sol 119. I woke up last night to the HAB shaking. The medium-grade sandstorm ended as suddenly as it began. It was only a Category 3 storm with 50 km/h winds. Nothing to worry about. Still, it's a bit disconcerting to hear howling winds when you're used to utter silence. I'm worried about Pathfinder. If the sandstorm damaged it, I'll have lost my connection to NASA. Logically, I shouldn't worry. The thing's been on the surface for decades. A little gale won't do any harm. When I head outside, I'll confirm Pathfinder's still functional before moving on to the sweaty, annoying work of the day. Yes, with each sandstorm comes the inevitable cleaning of the solar cells, a time-honored tradition by hardy Martians such as myself. It reminds me of growing up in Chicago and having to shovel snow. I'll give my dad credit. He never claimed it was to build character or teach me the value of hard work. Snowblowers are expensive, he used to say. You're free. Once I tried to appeal to my mom. Don't be such a wuss, she suggested. In other news, it's 7 sols till the harvest, and I still haven't prepared. For starters, I need to make a hoe. Also, I need to make an outdoor shed for the potatoes. I can't just pile them up outside. The next major storm would cause the Great Martian Potato Migration. Anyway, all that will have to wait. I've got a full day today. After cleaning the solar cells, I have to check the whole solar array to make sure the storm didn't hurt it. Then I'll need to do the same for the rover. I better get started. Airlock 1 slowly depressurized to 1/90th of an atmosphere. Watney, donning an EVA suit, waited for it to complete. He had done it literally hundreds of times. Any apprehension he may have had on Sol 1 was long gone. Now it was merely a boring chore before exiting to the surface. As the depressurization continued, the HAB's atmosphere compressed the airlock, and AL-102 stretched for the last time. On Sol 119, the HAB breached. The initial tear was less than 1 millimeter. The perpendicular carbon fibers should have prevented the rip from growing, but countless abuses had stretched the vertical fibers apart and weakened the horizontal ones beyond use. The full force of the HAB's atmosphere rushed through the breach. Within a tenth of a second, the rip was 1 meter long, running parallel to the seal strip. It propagated all the way around until it met its starting point. The airlock was no longer attached to the HAB. The unopposed pressure violently launched the airlock like a cannonball as the HAB exploded. Inside, the surprised Watney slammed against the airlock's back door with the force of the expulsion. The airlock flew 40 meters before hitting the ground. Watney, barely recovered from the earlier shock, now endured another as he hit the front door, face first. His faceplate took the brunt of the blow, the safety glass shattering into hundreds of small cubes. His head slammed against the inside of the helmet, knocking him senseless. The airlock tumbled across the surface for another 15 meters. The heavy padding of Watney's suit saved him from many broken bones. He tried to make sense of the situation, but was barely conscious. Finally done tumbling, the airlock rested on its side amid a cloud of dust. Watney, on his back, stared blankly upward through the hole in his shattered faceplate. A gash in his forehead trickled blood down his face. Regaining some of his wits, he got his bearings. Turning his head to the side, he looked through the back door's window. The collapsed HAB rippled in the distance, a junkyard of debris strewn across the landscape in front of it. Then a hissing sound reached his ears.
Listening carefully, he realized it was not coming from his suit. Somewhere in the phone booth-sized airlock, a small breach was letting air escape. He listened intently to the hiss. Then he touched his broken faceplate. Then he looked out the window again.
"You fucking kidding me," he said.